Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brad Wright, the host of today's show. Today, we'll be talking to Tanalis Padilla about her new book, Unintended Lessons of Revolution, Student Teachers and Political Radicalism in 20th Century Mexico. Tanalis Padilla is professor of history at MIT. She is a historian of Latin America who focuses on political and agrarian movements in modern Mexico. Her first book, Rural Resistance in the Land of Zapata, The Jaramillista Movement and the Myth of the Pax Priista, 1940 to 1962, published by Duke University Press in 2008, recounts the history of an agrarian movement that turned to armed struggle during an era of Mexican history previously considered one of social and political stability. She's co-editor and contributor to a 2013 special issue of the Journal of Iberian and Latin American Research that analyzes the implications of recently declassified intelligence documents for Mexico's post-revolutionary historiography. In Mexico, Professor Padilla is a frequent contributor to national newspaper La Jornada and has published an edited volume in Spanish entitled El Campesinado y su Persistencia en la Actualidad Mexicana from 2013, an interdisciplinary and binational work on the Mexican countryside and its recent past. And the Spanish translation of her first book, Después de Zapata, was published by Acal in September 2015. Tanalis Padilla, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brad. It's nice to be here and to be able to have this conversation about my book. Thank you.
Great to talk with you today. I wonder if we could begin the interview with you telling us how you became interested in the research questions that drive this study. I mean, what are the origins of unintended lessons of revolution?
Yeah, definitely. And I guess, like all book projects, sometimes there are, you know, multiple reasons that we decide to choose them, or in this case that I feel like they choose us, and this topic in some ways I think chose me. I guess, I mean, primarily the intellectual question or curiosity that first led me to explore it comes from the research I did on my first book, which, as you already mentioned, right, was on an agrarian movement during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And this is a book I started researching in 1999. When I first did my field research on it. And as I was doing, you know, interviews or looking at the documents, I kept running across in this campesino movement, rural teachers, you know, maestros rurales. And, you know, both in the, you know, the specific topic, but also as I was thinking about or reading broadly about peasant movements in Mexico in the 20th century, I saw that, you know, significant guerrilla leaders or prominent guerrilla leaders like Lucio Cabañas, Genaro Vázquez, Arturo Gamis, Pablo Gómez, were, you know, these were figures that in the 1960s and 70s took up armed struggle, they were themselves rural teachers. And so that struck me as a little bit odd, because just coming out of graduate school, you know, just finishing up my oral exams, one of the things that I had studied about rural teachers were much more about them as agents of state consolidation, of the revolutionary state consolidation, you know, going off to communities to establish allegiances to between these communities, or members of these communities, and the new state, right? A sort of way of forjar patria, or at the very least of being mediators, as, you know, Mary Kay Vaughan writes about teachers. So I was wondering, why do I keep encountering them as leaders of sometimes very militant movement against the state on whose behalf they were supposed to act? So that's sort of the question that for a long time nagged at me. And, you know, there's several answers to that and reasons that I'll explore in the book. But one of the reasons I initially found, or probably had to do with the time period for which teachers or the education system had been studied at that point, and what was not examined. So until recently, maybe, you know, kind of my generation of graduate students slash, you know, when we published our first book, those of mine in my generation in the, you know, early 2000s or first decade of 2000s, most of the historiography on 20th century Mexico was devoted to the revolution and to state consolidation, whereas the 1940s and beyond remained largely unexplored. So as we'll talk about a little bit later, I think that's, you know, part of the answer as to why teachers played what I thought was a different role. But in terms of going back to just real quickly, the question that, you know, kind of led me to this book, that was the main kind of what you would call intellectual or scholarly initial question. And then, of course, there's some aspects, you know, kind of personal and even political nature of my political commitment. Personally, I myself spent my childhood in rural Mexico. So the world of rural teachers and the world of rural students was not necessarily unfamiliar to me. So increasingly, as I began doing the research on this book, I found myself, you know, kind of going back to some of the things that as a kid I noticed in rural Mexico, but, you know, didn't understand, say, the way I do now as a scholar. And finally, politically, I have always in some way tried to participate in both, you know, in activist movements in some way, or contribute to the discourse, the dialogue, the struggle of those who seek, you know, in countless ways to fight for justice. And the fact that I kept noticing students, rural normalistas, out protesting again in at a time when socialism was considered over, when Marxist analysis was considered over, you know, because of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the fact that these students kept invoking Marx and Lenin and prominently held the, you know, hammer and sickle, that was intriguing, to say the least, and I wanted to find out more about that. So that's kind of, you know, the long or multifaceted reasons how I, you know, kind of began to get immersed in the topic.
Thank you so much for that, Tana Lise. And I think I would kind of build on what you were just saying about recent political developments and commitments and things. And in the course of your research and writing, I think, in 2014, there was an important episode in this ongoing history of rural normalistas. In September 2016, students from the teacher training college in Ayotzinapa in the state of Guerrero, and the state's repression of them and how 43 students had gone missing. And there's still, their parents still have a movement to find them, and it's gotten significant international support. And you begin the book talking about Ayotzinapa and the legacy of revolution. So I wonder if you might start there in terms of getting into to the body of this book.
Yeah, yes, of course. And I, you know, Ayotzinapa was an incredibly significant moment, right? That moment you described in September 2014, when students had taken over a bus or several buses, a practice that's common that's been common among normalistas and other types of students, you know, in decades past. And they had done this to go in preparation to go to the demonstration of October 2nd, the commemoration of the 1968 Tlatelolco massacre. And yeah, as they were exiting the town of Iguala with the buses they had procured for students, not just students at Ayotzinapa to attend, but from all the students of the rural normales to be able to attend, they were stopped by armed gunmen and state and municipal police very close to a military base. And they were shot at. Three normalistas were killed. One was brutally tortured and found dead with his face torn off. Three other civilians were killed. Many were injured. And as you mentioned, 43 students were taken and have not been heard of since. And so this was, yeah, in 2014. By then, I had started research and even writing this book, you know, for quite a few years. And yet in Mexico, for the most part, rural normales were not much known about or discussed. They weren't in part of public consciousness at all. Here and there, you'd have, you know, demonstrations by these students and, you know, would come out on the press, and then things would calm down and people would not talk about it anymore. And so these schools were primarily thought about as kind of, you know, some relics of the past, with, you know, uppity poor students, to the extent that they were even thought about. And yet this episode, you know, was significant in that it brought, because the government tried to dismiss it first as a local effort and then just as, you know, kind of a drug cartel, students being either involved in drug cartels, they try to imply, you know, and thus being attacked because of that, or trying to say that they were at best at, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's what they get for, you know, for being such troublemakers. So that's how the government then tried to dismiss it, the administration of Enrique Peña Nieto. But the population didn't accept it, and a massive demonstrations, you know, happened throughout Mexico and then internationally. And significantly, in terms of the significance of this moment was, you know, aside from the fact that it brought the history or the, you know, the visibility of these schools into public light, it also, there was a question by some about why this incident of violence against civilians elicited such demonstrations when there had already been so many attacks on civilians. And, you know, by then, the number's much higher now, but by then there were already 100,000 victims of the drug war declared in 2006, and about 25,000 disappeared. So the question was, why this and not other such violence elicited this massive demonstration? And one of the things, you know, and here a little bit coming back to my study, that I think helps explain it. It's not the only thing, but one of the things that helps explain why this case drew so much attention, I think, has to do precisely with the radical tradition of these students and the fact that as soon as this happened, they mobilized, they mobilized other students from other schools, they mobilized their parents, they mobilized the population in general to decry this instance of state violence. And they succeeded in touching a nerve by a population that was really, you know, fed up by such long-term violence, not to mention corruption and state abuse, you know, that we talk about more. So I think those two levels are really significant for the understanding of rural normalistas and their tradition of political mobilization.
Your book moves primarily chronologically through three major periods in this history of student teachers and the institution of rural normales. Let's start with the first, if you would, Tanalis, in the period of what you call revolutionary state consolidation during the 20s and 30s. And I just wanted to read to begin with a quote from page 2 of the book. And maybe we can highlight especially the period under President Lázaro Cárdenas. But here you say, the institutions that would train these educators acquired many of their defining characteristics during the presidency of Lázaro Cárdenas, 1934 to 1940, whose numerous progressive reforms included socialist education. Although socialist education was short-lived as official policy and never clearly defined by its state architects, at rural normales its meaning was simple and enduring: justice, education for the poor, a student voice in institutional practices, and class consciousness constituted defining elements of normalista culture, reproduced in subsequent decades thanks to student collective action. So if you could just maybe talk a little about that period of the 20s and 30s as the institution got established.
Yeah, of course. And you know, this period is, you know, as the quote indicates there, I mean, especially the 1930s, just absolutely fundamental in understanding, I guess, the thread that runs through my whole book, or the larger question that I try to answer is, well, why and how did these schools developed this tradition of political radicalism? So the origin, the roots of this lie in the 1920s and 30s. And the 1920s, you know, in terms of the process of state consolidation, which, as you know, kind of we all know, is that it was both a top-down and a bottom-up process. But in terms of the for the purposes of this book, the bottom up process that involved the agrarian longings or demands implicit in the revolution, even though the more radical tradition of the revolution that led by Zapata and Villa was, you know, ostensibly defeated, it still had to be incorporated into this project of national consolidation. So these schools, the education that students acquired at these schools was not only, as you know, when I first started this project, I thought to become agents of state consolidation. Yes, the state wanted and needed that, right? But it also meant understanding principles of justice, which gave legitimacy to that state, to those to the poor. And so that's kind of, you know, in the 1920s. And then in the 1930s, this really gets codified by when you have this kind of effervescence of the more radical principles in the Constitution actually being applied, among them socialist education. And, you know, socialist education, aside from, you know, what it may have meant, and as I said, you know, in the book, it's vague. It did indeed mean the eventual, you know, kind of appropriation of the means of production by the proletariat. To others, it just meant, you know, anti-clerical education. But the fact that it was a structuring principle, as I said, really allowed students to explore it and use it as a stand-in for justice, and this dynamic played out in several ways, and I'll try to be brief here. But one of those ways was just the fact that it meant that the teacher needed to be a community activist as well, and by that, community leader and helping the populations they instructed demand their rights, right? Demand their agrarian rights, demand union rights, demand cooperatives. So right from the outset, the students at the Normales were going to be trained to be leaders so that they could help implement these principles of justice. Excuse me. But also this meant that, how do you train them to be leaders? Well, you give them a say in the institutions which they're students so that they can start exercising their voice. Or as some school administrators believed, you know, we have to make these meek, passive campesinos be leaders, you know. And so you can tell sort of the judgment that's there. But that meant that they began this active participation since their schools. And so this was also a part of the legacy of socialist education. And finally, just socialist education, again, even if it just meant understanding the history of the Mexican Revolution or analyzing systems of exploitation or understanding class, went a long way in denaturalizing poverty and beginning to provide the tools which could be honed either through more analysis or through struggle itself to continue to participate when the time was ripe or when opportunity necessitated it. And finally, I just thought of one other thing that's important. The SEP itself, the Ministry of Public Education, had several important Marxists among its teachers, among its intellectuals, at one point among the Minister of Education, himself in the 30s. And so it took a while to kind of get rid of all of them later on. So that meant that you actually had an educational institution that had a broad, often radical ideological spectrum.
And was there a shift, if we're thinking about a period that's the 1920s and the 1930s, with the institution established in the wake of the revolution in the 20s, was there a shift under Cárdenas between 34 and 40? I mean, we know there was after Cárdenas in terms of the state's policies towards these students and institutions. But were there a couple of changes, in the late 20s, say, or 30s that we should know about?
Yeah, yes, definitely. And I'm glad you asked that question, because the 20s and 30s are very different periods, even if there isn't a clear divide, or even if that divide may or may not be, 1934 when Cárdenas took office. I guess in broad terms, the most important way of understanding the shift would be, again, in general terms, that I think the 1920s, and especially under presidents like Calles, emphasized much more principles of, one could say, modernity or modernization of agriculture, technification of agriculture. So Calles even saw kind of individual small farmers as the kind of the model to go by. And some of these schools in the 1920s were kind of more agricultural schools under the principle that as long as you teach the future teachers how to produce, in the modern forms of production or more efficient forms of production, that'll improve the campesino condition. Whereas under Cárdenas and under socialist education, those principles get extended or linked to social questions or social conditions themselves. That tendency that I mentioned already about teachers being community leaders, that was much more emphasized in the 30s than in the 1920s. It was there in the 1920s, but it was emphasized a lot more in the 30s. Also, in the 1930s is when these schools were made explicitly for the sons and daughters of campesinos, of rural poor people. Before, in the 1920s, there wasn't kind of explicit requirements about who could go to these schools. And in the 1930s, they started asking for documentation, and specifically thinking of these schools as they are for the sons and daughters of the rural poor. There was an exception that children of rural teachers themselves, not necessarily economically privileged, right? But the children of rural teachers could also attend these schools. Anyway, so part of the thinking was, well, campesinos will be the ones, the most committed teachers. But the other part of the thinking was, again, and we come back to this principle of justice, right? The revolution necessitated a redistribution of wealth. And, you know, you can think of redistribution of wealth in the kind of straightforward way, the way Cárdenas expropriated haciendas and divided the land and gave it to campesinos. Or you can also think about it about through the establishment of institutions and the granting these institutions resources for the education or social mobility of the poor. And these were one such institutions. And that transformation happened during the 30s. And one more thing that's important during the 30s, which I'm sure we'll get into later, but I'll just mention it now, was the creation of the Federación de Estudiantes Campesinos Socialistas de México, the FECSEM, its acronym in Spanish, and readers probably understand, but it was the Federation of Socialist Campesino Students of Mexico, which was an organization that represented all of the rural normales in Mexico, and that was created in 1935, and that has important implications regarding socialist educations and that time period, which we can talk about, at some point.
Yes. What about, Tanalis, the communities where rural normales were set up and established? And as the book lays out, and it's kind of dizzying how much this changed, but initially, at least, where were some of the schools set up and why the particular communities? And I think that feeds into this part about teachers as community leaders, because the idea was they were particularly needed in these zones of the country, right?
Right. Yeah. And to be honest, there is not a simple answer to this, partly because it was so unstable. And so the short answer was there was an attempt to establish these schools in rural areas that wasn't always successful towards the beginning, because it had to do with a confluence of factors. Where can you get some land to set the school up, right? Where do you have the necessary teachers to set the teachers of the rural, you know, who would instruct the future teachers to come together? So in the 20s and even in the 30s, I would venture to say it probably was haphazard is probably not the correct word, but less deliberate than you might think, and often had to do with local initiatives as much and maybe even more than it had to do with federal, with the central government's initiative. So, I mean, if we even take the example of Ayotzinapa, right, that there was an hacienda, a former landed estate that could be expropriated, in some cases donated and sometimes bought. There was the first director, Raúl Isidro Burgos, who was really committed to the idea of rural education, and even donated some of his own kind of resources to help the school going. There were community members there who wanted a school. So it has to do with those types of local dynamics in places like Michoacán, both a hotbed of, you know, Cardenismo, that's Cárdenas's home state, but also of Cristero radicalism, right, or, you know, right wing anti-teacher sentiment. Schools moved around or, you know, had to close down sometimes because of that. So I guess, again, especially in the first two decades, schools changed location and were quite precarious and, you know, kind of didn't get kind of solidly on the ground, maybe even until the 40s or 1950s, ironically, although some of the kind of more established ones, like Ayotzinapa, can trace their specific kind of sites to the 1920s.
And then after the Cardenas presidency, beginning in 1940, you note in the book that Mexico's education spending since 1940, quote, operated under a palliative rather than transformative logic. And then we see that at each turn throughout this history, while students and others are demanding a structural take on things. There's that insistence on the palliative approach by the state, as you mentioned. Could you start there in talking about the 40s through the 60s period? I know there's a lot going on there.
There is a lot, and so I'll try to kind of be either brief or general.
Sure.
So as again, the 1940s, after Cárdenas leaves office, marks a transition. Although, as scholars of Mexico know, doesn't begin exactly on December 1st, 1940, right? Cárdenas's own project begins to face some contradictions towards the end of his own presidency. But the significance for this project or for the Rural Normales is that with the beginning of the Ávila Camacho administration, the privileging of the countryside as the site for redistributive wealth or for structural transformation rather really ends, and the focus begins to be much more on the cities, and also there is no longer kind of this sense of redistribution in the sense that those who have a lot of money have some of it, taken away in the sense of in the form of expropriation of wealth or nationalization of wealth. But Mexico, as a country, begins an enormous level of economic growth, right? What we know of as the Mexican miracle. And much of this growth actually comes at the expense of the countryside, right? With prices for products that campesinos sell low, or because of there's major subsidies for large agricultural projects, and many of them begin to have the logic be to sell in winter vegetables or fruits. But anyway, what this means for the countryside is the ejido, like the rural normales, begin to have less attention or sympathy, and start to flounder in many ways. But it doesn't mean that Mexico doesn't spend a lot of money on education. It does. It continues to build schools, and especially a little later on in the 50s and 60s, and continues to build infrastructure for education again in the cities, and to continue to offer jobs to teachers. However, the fact that major infrastructural projects and attention to the countryside is not happening means that there is a large-scale migration to the cities, and as we all know, also to the United States. So what I discuss here in terms of the struggle that develops between rural normalistas and the state is their constant sort of demand for more resources, even more schools, while the government is spending some public resources on education, but not necessarily on the countryside, or not necessarily engaging in a project of kind of real social development that might either prevent the migration to the cities, or that could provide the countryside with solid public infrastructure beyond, kind of one classroom schools. Also, we could think of hospitals, roads, all that type of public infrastructure for a more equitable distribution of wealth.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Sure. And into the later 40s, 50s, 60s, we're into the Cold War context. And this is particularly important for the Normalistas context and the way that people in Mexico, kind of on different sides, discussed education and engaged with it. Could you talk a little bit about maybe from chapter five, you know, you sort of zero in on the northern state of Chihuahua in the late 50s and early 60s and discuss some of the key figures in Normales lore, Pablo Gomez, Arturo Gámez. But could you just give us a little state level or localized texture from this chapter five on Chihuahua?
Sure, of course. And this, you know, kind of one of the things that begins to happen and that is, I think, key to this debate about kind of just spending on education as a palliative measure versus a fundamental redistribution of wealth is the Cuban Revolution, right? So that happens in 1959. And as it is in other parts of Latin America and to students, you know, kind of worldwide, it's a huge sort of inspiration to Normalistas. And this gets manifested in the state of Chihuahua among local activists. So, you know, Arturo Gámez and Pablo Gómez, who themselves were Normalistas in that they trained at a normal, but it was actually not a rural normal. But Gomez taught at a rural normal in Chihuahua, and Pablo Gámez mobilized among a lot of their students and was a rural school teacher. And these figures and this time period, and I guess the case of Chihuahua that I discuss in chapter five, is significant for several reasons. First, it represents a bit of a transition in ideology between the kind of Cardenista model to which students constantly appeal to, like, you know, kind of we need to return to that, or we need to base projects on that type of an ideology in a teacher as community leader, to more of a kind of what you would think of a more modern or new left type of socialism, right? Where you have the example of the Cuban Revolution and sort of a push to sort of think that a full-flung socialist revolution might be possible, and that you take much more kind of a anti-imperialist, overtly anti-imperialist rhetoric, right? So you begin to see this shift, and it's not necessarily abandoning Cardenismo, but it's incorporating these principles of anti-imperialism and, you know, kind of 1960s socialism, if you will, or as I put it in the book, combination of old and new left principles. The other thing that's really striking about the case of Chihuahua in the early 1960s is that this is when you have the clearest example of rural normalistas participating in land takeovers and campesino land takeovers. So these are students who often, you know, mobilized for the, you know, basics of their institutions. But during this time period in the 60s, and especially in Chihuahua, you see them, you know, participating in sit-ins and takeovers with the campesino population who was still in desperate need of land, and or many of the land they had acquired had been reversed, that process, because of the accumulation or kind of a predominance of latifundios, large land extensions, in Chihuahua. So you see this clear alliance between the two groups, one that, you know, kind of eventually ends up in a attempted armed uprising or attack on the military barracks in Madera with the participation of, you know, or leadership of Gamis and Gomez, with the participation of some graduates of the Rural Normales, right? And then with the kind of commemoration by Rural Normalistas of this act. So that's another thing that you see in this episode and during this time period. And finally, one of the things you see here is this, you know, 1968 is often taken as, you know, a watershed, or if nothing else, the attention that the student movement in Mexico City received, partly because of the repression with which it was ended in the Tlatelolco massacre. But if you look at episodes like Chihuahua and the participation of Rural Normalistas, you see that student activism was a phenomenon, not just outside urban centers, outside Mexico City, but actually a rural phenomenon as well, which we don't tend to think of student movements as in the countryside. And you see it's a very interesting combination of a campesino identity, you know, with all the significance that implies because of the Mexican Revolution, and a student identity, which is so key to the kind of zeitgeist, you know, of the 1960s in terms of student participation and leftist movements.
I think there's also another perception of Normalistas, maybe by some of us, that that we see kind of mostly men or boys in the public protests. But could you talk a little about the gender in this study, and especially the place of women's Normalis when they started to have those?
Yeah.
And in addition, Tanalise, you make some important points about indigenous identity and some of the struggles there with many Normalistas from indigenous communities. If you could touch on those couple of things.
Sure. Yeah. So it's interesting because, yeah, the male teacher as a kind of political or as a leadership was very much iconic, both in terms of shortly after the revolution, who the state thought of, even though the teaching profession has historically been one accessible to women, right? And then today, I think even in the images you see today of Normalista protests, you often see, you know, young men protesting to the extent that these protests have come from schools like Ayotzinapa and, say, Michoacán Tiripetío. The schools are divided by gender, or most of them are. And Ayotzinapa is a male school. So that's one of the reasons, you know, since it's so prominent that you see male students, right? But certainly the schools were so important for female students as well, for all sorts of reasons. First of all, you know, women were just as involved politically or in these mobilizations as men were, but as is often the case, either there was a gendered division of labor in that women were, you know, kind of behind the scenes, sometimes asked to, you know, make sure that, you know, when cafeteria services were suspended, make sure that they could keep providing food, you know, and that kind of traditional division of labor, or the leadership roles or the, you know, people who spoke were often men. Nonetheless, when you speak to women who went to these schools or who participated in these movements, you see how important they were in a form of self-empowerment. And this could occur for many reasons. You know, maybe the most obvious would be kind of access to a profession, right? You went to these schools and then you would be able to be a teacher and then have some form of independence by having your own profession. But the other, and many of them actually say more than that, was the kind of experience of political mobilization, even if they did not continue to be activists after, which some did, they say, well, you know, when you're there and, you know, you go take over, land takeover in the middle of the night, or you're supposed to defy school authorities, or you confront the police, that gives you a lot of courage. And that gives you a lot of, you know, kind of a sense of being able to be assertive and to be able to find your voice and to not accept, you know, kind of being relegated to kind of second class. So a lot of them cite that as a form of empowerment and a testament to how, you know, how much women actually participated. Again, if we come back to the chapter on Chihuahua, is that, you know, kind of the governor and all of those were maligning women, and of course in gendered forms. Like, what are they doing sleeping out there, you know, with campesinos, implying, you know, that they were somehow doing a disservice to their honor. And, you know, then leftist campesino organizations would come out to defend them in paternalistic terms, you know, saying, oh, we respect them, you know. But women themselves were really overall empowered by their access to these schools and by the political mobilizations at these schools. And something similar, though distinct, happens with Indigenous students. Again, if you come back to some of the principal tropes of the revolution or rhetoric, it's the campesino identity, right? And even the mestizo identity as opposed to Indigenous, although there is a tribute to Mexico's Indigenous heritage. If you think about the student federation that I mentioned, that's campesino and socialista, they claim the campesino identity, right? And if you look at much of their rhetoric, it's very much in this tradition, but especially in schools that are in predominantly indigenous areas, like the rural normales in Oaxaca and in Chiapas, and even to a certain extent Guerrero or Ayotzinapa. There is a predominance of indigenous students, and there the identity is much more fluid, where you have a process, and it also depends on time period, you know, during actually most of the 20th century, where access to school meant access to learning Spanish, meant learning the, you know, dominant language and being able to go back to communities armed with the language of the government to be able to defend communities who couldn't because they didn't speak the language. You know, I'm simplifying a bit, but that type of rhetoric. But especially towards the end of the 20th century, and, you know, here I think the Zapatista movement in Chiapas was invaluable in this, there is much more of a claim to indigenous identity. And even today, much more of an emphasis at these schools, again, especially in indigenous areas, that the curriculum should include more of a consciousness to what it would mean to teach in indigenous communities, not just campesinos assumed to be Spanish speakers or that they should be Spanish speakers.
Thank you for that. Moving on just a little bit to kind of 1968 and beyond, since we often, those of us who study late 20th century Mexico, that's such a key moment for us.
Yeah.
And we know that it was for normalistas also.
Uh-huh.
But what about 1969 in terms of the reform handed down by the SEP?
Yeah.
And how that affected rural normales going forward.
Right. Yeah. And you know, 69 is a date that normalistas and, you know, almost everyone else who talks about normales rurales will bring up over and over, and for good reason, right? I mean, in one way, it connects them to 1968 in the sense that rural normalistas were, you know, active before, as we already mentioned in case of Chihuahua, but there are other examples, but also in the movement of 1968 itself, right? So in this nationally recognized student movement, but also this reform that happens in 1969 under the Azordaz is that of the 29 rural normales that existed then, 14 of them are turned into what are called technical agricultural schools. And so you only have 15 normales left. And in those normales, those 15, which used to include both junior high, with previously included junior high and high school, so a total of 6 years and sometimes even a couple of preliminary years for those who hadn't finished elementary school, those ostensibly 6 years are cut to 3 years, in that now you need to enter a normal after you have finished junior high school. So it's a cut in the number of institutions, but significantly from the point of view of the student organizations and from the point of view of politicizing the student body, it's a cut in the number of years you have to politicize and organize students. And students throughout the Rural Normales resisted this change. They knew it was coming when it was announced. They occupied schools. They traveled to each other's schools. They tried to do roadblocks, all that. And they were fought tooth and nail, in some cases, you know, by the army occupations. In other cases, the schools were just kind of not opened until, you know, the students abandoned them. And ultimately, they were unable to reverse this the closure of half of their schools. So rural normalistas often cite this as a retaliation for 68. So again, connecting themselves to this broad social movement, but also saying, like, you know, we would have been able to continue that movement, the student movement that was ended, you know, in other circumstances, but Díaz Ordaz, you know, and the Ministry of Public Education eliminated half of our schools so that we wouldn't continue. So that's sort of seen as a sort of a huge watershed and a form of, you know, kind of political repression under the guise of an educational reform.
And then during the 1970s, there was a number of, in rural and urban areas, guerrilla movements across Mexico, armed revolutionary movements. And could you talk a little about, the book goes into it, and it's really interesting about the movements involving Lucio Cabañas, former leader of the FECSIM, and just generally the connection between normales or some normalistas and armed movements of the 70s.
Yeah. And so here it's where, you know, kind of almost talking about, you know, kind of the 60s or 68 or 69 is one period, and the 70s are another, and again, in which, you know, historians of modern Mexico have often, you know, kind of looked at 68 as the end either of a miracle or of a particular type of protest, or trying to establish the continuities between the protests, you know, before and after. But then the 1970s as a period of kind of crisis, you know, an economic model, and then a type of protest that is much more radical because of 68, right? So 68 to many is a proof that, you know, legal means are not going to get you anywhere. So clandestine struggle becomes much more in vogue. And so you have, you know, one of the most famous guerrilla groups here is that led by Lucio Cabañas, you know, and, you know, separately, but in the same state, Genaro Vázquez, who himself was also a rural teacher from Guerrero, though did not study at Ayotzinapa, but is often claimed by Ayotzinapa students as one of theirs. And in the murals that you see at Ayotzinapa, you see Lucio Cabañas, but also Genaro Vázquez. But two things about this. Partly because leaders like Lucio Cabañas, you know, kind of were not only graduates of Rural Normales, but also head of the Student Federation, the FECSIM, there begins to be an association between guerrilla movements and Rural Normales, right? And, you know, one of the many often disparaging terms that's still used to talk about rural normales among dominant or mainstream society is that, you know, they're nidos guerrilleros or communist seedbeds or guerrilla seedbeds. And to a certain extent, it's hard. I have not seen data. Maybe at some point we'll have this. You know, how, what proportion of the of armed guerrilla struggles in terms of students, what proportion came from rural normales and what came from others? I don't know that we have that. So I can't say with certainty that more came. You know, I'm not even sure if that's the case, right? But the association is there. And certainly rural normales had the conditions to be able to participate in guerrilla movements, partly because they were in remote areas, partly because students there had the independence from their parents because they lived in dorms, right? And partly because they came from this kind of radical tradition, continued to study and emphasize political formation as, you know, not as part of the curriculum, but students themselves. It would be impossible for you to study at a rural normal and not be exposed to Marxism. So, you know, if you were receptive, they could provide an entree into it. And certainly, you know, with most normalistas I talked to, especially those who studied in the 60s and especially 70s, you had, you know, I talked to either people who had been part of the guerrilla, who knew someone close who had been part of the guerrilla, or who themselves, you know, helped out in some way with the guerrilla. And here, the way 68 is cited by many as an example of students or of legal channels of participation being closed, 69 among normalistas is cited as like, look, you know, they're closing our schools down. You know, that's another instance of repression and as a kind of logic for armed struggle.
So part of that, for some students who were did participate or showed solidarity, it was a matter of how political consciousness had developed over time. And that's one of the themes of your book, political consciousness and its development. And I was wondering, you know, as a historian, how do you sort of get a handle on that? What kinds of sources did you turn to in this book? You mentioned talking with normalistas, and I think there's 50 plus interviews that you used here. What kinds of, in addition to oral histories, what kinds of sources did you use to get at political consciousness?
Yeah, thanks. It's first I'll say that it's a hard thing to get at, right? Because it's not always tangible. It's something that's changes that, you know, in one person's life can change. And it's also something that, you know, emerges among in context of broader movements, not necessarily you kind of just, you know, you have it and then you have it and then it never goes away type of thing, right? But yeah, so aside from oral histories, which are kind of probably the primary vehicle to get at consciousness, more than anything, because you get students or former students reflecting and the contradictions that are involved in memory and in consciousness come out there. And, you know, and for a historian, there's a lot of sort of meat there to analyze. But I mean, ironically, the documents of the state are also very useful in getting at consciousness, because so you have the intelligence sources in Mexico, as we now know, since the archives were declassified, spied on everyone and everything. We're also, you know, spying on the rural normales, sometimes sending daily reports, probably had, you know, people there infiltrated or people who they paid to give information. And just there, if you can call it analysis, and sometimes it's analysis, sometimes it's just kind of descriptive reporting, you know, they constantly are reporting on the types of actions or dynamics taking place among the students. And so that's a way to kind of observe, you know, kind of the manifestations of consciousness. If oral history is a way to get people to reflect or to talk about what they did or what they thought they were doing, these reports are a kind of descriptive sort of observation on what they did, right? You also have reports of the meetings, the debates they held, and then the student proclamations themselves, what their demands are, how they're framing these demands, you know, proclamations from the student organization, you know, how they write them, and what terms or frameworks they justify and on that they justify them under, I think gives an interesting perspective on how they are thinking about their struggle for justice. So I think those were some of the main sources to get at consciousness. You know, I used other sources such as, you know, students, especially for the earlier periods, what they wrote in their assignments or, you know, kind of final term papers, and the way it's always interesting to see how they digested the pedagogy or the instructions they had from, you know, from their teachers. So I think those were some of the main ways to think about and to talk about consciousness. And then, of course, to just look at the reports of their actions, right? Their strikes, their when they joined campesino or worker organizations, when they joined student protests, are another way.
Thanks so much, Tanalis. I think maybe to kind of conclude our time together, I wonder if we might talk about developments in normalismo, in rural normales among student teacher activism there since roughly 2000, you know, and then maybe particularly thinking about how things have developed under the López Obrador administration in the last couple of years, which at least coming into office represented a shift politically.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little about more recent context in light of what you've laid out here?
Sure, definitely. So I think you could almost have like three different dynamics affecting or as a framework or context to talk about rural normales since 2000. One and maybe even more since 2006, but one would be the kind of educational reforms that really got going more under Calderón. That's why I say 2006, although 2000 is an important year for a reason I'll get to in a second. But so it's as if the logic of neoliberalism, which, you know, is from the 80s, was already anathema to, or the normales rurales were anathema to the logic of neoliberalism, right? Because they are a form of social public goods. But since the 2000s, there have been educational reforms that affecting teachers, for example, you know, teachers' tenure, eliminating one thing that has always been cherished by normalistas of their schools is that they were guaranteed a job after graduation in the countryside, right? They were trained to teach the countryside and then given a job. That was eliminated more recently in 2012. And if those of us who pay attention to kind of Mexican current events might remember, under the Peña Nieto administrations, and I mean, even before that, under Calderón, teachers were one of the most kind of vocal and vociferous protesters to the economic reforms under the PAN and under the PRI. In fact, their opposition to many of the aspects that would have, you know, ended many of their labor rights and privatized many forms of education, and even, you know, proposals more recently to eliminate normales themselves, so that teachers can be trained anywhere, not at specific schools. Teachers have been really active participants, and within these movements, graduates of normales rurales or even students have participated. So that's one context to understand the normales recently. The other is, of course, Ayotzinapa in 2014, which I already mentioned, so I won't get into that more. But just to say, and this can even be seen even since the election of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is that normalistas, the rural normales still keep appearing in the news as sites of conflict. So most recently, you have just last Friday, rural normalistas from Ayotzinapa trying to take over the toll booths in Guerrero to demand some kind of, you know, response. They're still searching for their compañeros. They're missing 43 students, right? And the National Guard and state police blocking them, and the confrontation that involves students, you know, throwing rocks and stones, you know. So you have that. And just before that, last year, you had students in Chiapas, the rural normal in Chiapas, wanting to take their exam, protesting that they had to take their exam virtually on computers when most of them are from schools where they've never worked with their computers because sometimes it's not even electricity. So they didn't want to take these exams online, and they were seriously repressed by the state government, and many were jailed, eventually released. So you still continue to have that. And much of the reason you have that is because while rural normales are still under federal jurisdiction, they still receive funding from the federal government, it is up to state governments to administer these funds. So often when students protest, they're protesting against the state governments, often incidentally because those state governments are cutting the number of spots at these schools, and the students are fighting to preserve the same number. So you still continue to see that, even with governors ostensibly from the same party as Morena or as AMLO. The shift you do see is in the language of López Obrador in some ways. He at one point stated, I am not the Díaz Ordaz. I'm not going to repress. I'm not going to, you know, close these schools. I empathize with you and your needs. So at least you have a rhetoric from someone who has proclaimed to be, you know, against neoliberalism, although, you know, with his actions, we can debate that, right? But at the same time, this, and has also expressed a commitment to find out and to go to the root of justice for the missing 43, right, in Ayotzinapa. And yet you still have some of the same dynamics at play, where students are still forced to protest and often given to armed skirmishes, and then they are dismissed by mainstream as, you know, revoltosos, as troublemakers, as violent. And why do they constantly have to use violence? So in some ways, you have a continuation of the dynamic we have seen historically, and it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out, right? We are not just in a shift with AMLO, who, you know, after a long time of neoliberal governments, you have someone with a left-leaning discourse and some of the actions to, you know, kind of be consistent with that, although, you know, again, that's problematic. But finally, this is the 100th year anniversary of the founding of the first rural normal in Michoacán. And so it's going to be very interesting to see if the legacy, you know, in this 100th anniversary under a government that calls itself leftist, if this can actually solidify you know, the compromiso to rural normales, these institutions of, you know, what Armand would might call the third transformation, if his is indeed the fourth transformation, or if you will see their further and continued weakening, which would be particularly tragic if it were to occur under a leftist government.
Ta-Nehisi Padilla's new book is Unintended Lessons of Revolution: Student Teachers and Political Radicalism in 20th Century Mexico. Ta-Nehisi, I appreciate your time. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. It was such a pleasure to talk about this book with you in such detail. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.